Earlier today, the MK party appeared in court to contest the IEC's decision to bar Jacob Zuma, former President Jacob Zuma, from participating in the elections. Zuma, the former president of the Republic of South Africa, received a 15-month prison sentence in 2021 for contempt of court, which serves as one of the grounds for disqualification. And we're going to be asking the question this evening, is there any hope for success in this legal battle? Or should former President Jacob Zuma and the MK party surrender? Joining me to have this discussion is Lindon Duli, attorney at ENS Africa. He joins me now on the line. Lindon, thank you so much, my brother. I appreciate your time and agreeing to talk to me.
Oh, thank you very much for having me, Aubrey. And good evening to all your listeners.
So we have yet another case that has to do with the Jacob Zuma MK contestation for a place in the contestation of power come the 29th of May this year. Today's case was really about President Jacob Zuma and the fact that the IEC has barred him from participating because he was sentenced at some point to prison. Is there a legal basis for what the IEC has done?
I must say, Aubrey, that this is one interesting case and technical, so to speak. And of course, in the introduction, you say that it's one that disallows Jacob Zuma from standing as a candidate in the upcoming election. But the counsel for MK, or to put it differently, the counsel for Jacob Zuma has put this into threefold. It says that it's not just about Jacob Zuma, but it's about the members of MK parties who would be voting for MK party on the basis of President Zuma being a candidate. But two, it's also about President Zuma's political rights to participate, but also beyond participating to stand for office. And thirdly, it is the party of MK party as a political party to elect or nominate its representative to stand for office. And to your question, there are three grounds that they have based this decision or this case on. And the first ground is on what is called in law ultra vires. And that is basically to say the IEC acted beyond its powers when it made a determination that Jacob Zuma was not fit for office. But maybe let me put it differently and let me be legally and politically correct. When it made the determination, or rather upheld the objection that was raised against Jacob Zuma's candidacy, why does it say this? And it particularly looks at the construct of the Constitution. Now, we know that Section 47 of the Constitution is the provision in law that makes the right to anyone who qualifies to vote to be eligible to stand for office as a candidate, or rather in the National Assembly. But of importance is the exception that is included under that legislation. It basically says you can stand as a member of the National Assembly, except, amongst other things, what is important for this discussion, a person who is convicted of an offense and sentenced to more than 12 months imprisonment without the option of a fine. So that's the first ground, and they're saying that the IEC does not have the authority to implement Section 47 of the Constitution, merely because the IEC derives its powers and function from the very Constitution. And the functions in terms of the Constitution of the IEC are basically to manage elections in terms of legislation, to ensure free and fair elections, and to declare election results. And therefore, to the extent that the IEC now derives its powers from the Constitution, that is not legally permissible, particularly because the IEC must contain its operations within the framework of the Electoral Act. And the Electoral Act does not allow, this is the argument once again from MK, does not allow the IEC to make such determination to remove someone from the candidate list on the basis that they do not qualify. It further argued on this point that it is the function and the power of the National Assembly to disallow certain members that do not qualify based on whatever criteria that they might be using, merely because if you look at the construct of Section 47, its entire preamble is on the National Assembly or Parliament, so to speak. So insofar as that constitution speaks of matters of Parliament, matters of the National Assembly, the IEC cannot intervene and interfere with the powers of the National Assembly. So that's the first point. But we have to now look at how the IEC responded to this case. And by the IEC, I'm referring to the council.
Yes.
They've basically objected on the grounds that, well, the powers that the IEC derives from the constitution are imported by law into Section 30 of the Electoral Act. And when you look at Section 30 of the Electoral Act, it basically says that the IEC, anyone, or rather to put it differently, anyone, including the chairperson of the IEC or the CEO of the IEC, may object against a candidate being presented by any political party, and that import is derived from the constitution. And once again, when we go back to Section 27 of the Electoral Act, it basically says that each party has the responsibility, and I'm paraphrasing it, to submit a list of candidates to the IEC upon a certain time, but also there must be a declaration that is submitted with the prescribed form, and that declaration, it must be declared that each candidate that is who is before the IEC is fit for the election, so to speak, qualifies to stand in the upcoming election.
So the argument there is that the powers vested in Section 47 of the Constitution are devolved to the IEC through Act Number 30 of the Electoral Act.
That is correct.
Okay.
Act Number 30 and Act Number 127.
Right.
So, I think as far as my view is concerned, that matter is settled on that score alone, that the legislation, the Constitution, gives powers to the IEC to decide on matters in terms of what it is prescribed to it in terms of national legislation. And then when you look at the national legislation, the IEC Act, or rather the Electoral Act, it then says that the IEC has the powers to decide on the candidacy or on who qualifies and to entertain objections on those bases.
Right.
So I think as far as that matter is concerned, I think that's a certain score. But the second ground that they are relying on is the ground of the conviction of President Zuma and the sentence of President Zuma by the Constitutional Court. Now, you correctly alluded to the 15-month imprisonment and imposed sentence by the Constitutional Court to President Zuma following the Zondo Commission matters and his defiance of that matter. And what the MK is relying on here is that because the Constitutional Court convicted President Zuma without his rights in terms of Section 35, that conviction was sui generis. It was unique, and it is not like any other convictions that we see in other cases where an accused person, for instance, has the right to appeal the matter. The centrality of that issue is just based on the right to appeal. So on the basis that Zuma could not appeal the decision of the Constitutional Court, that conviction as envisioned is not the one that is contemplated by Section 47 of the Constitution. And like I had, just to appraise your listeners based on what Section 47 says, to just remind them, it basically says that anyone can stand for office as a member of the National Assembly except a person who is convicted of an offence or sentenced to more than 12 years imprisonment. So the MK is saying...
12 years or 12 months?
12 months, yes.
Yep.
12 months, that's correct.
Right. Okay.
Thanks for that. So MK is saying, well, this conviction here that Section 47 is speaking of is certainly not the conviction of the Constitutional Court, merely because the con- the conviction contemplated by Section 4 is the conviction that constitutionally qualifies with all rights that accrue to an accused person, which primarily includes the right to an appeal. So to the extent that Zuma did not have that right, the right to be heard as an accused person, the conviction can't be said to have been a conviction that is contemplated by Section 47. And therefore, on those bases, the matter must fail because there was no conviction, so to speak, that is constitutionally
but
compliant.
But there was a conviction.
Absolutely.
The fact that the grounds upon the conviction was made are arguable and debatable is one issue.
Yes.
A conviction was made. That is a matter of record, right?
That is a matter of record. Now, what they are relying on, MK, is basically saying, well, even the Constitutional Court did pronounce on this matter being an unconventional case. And therefore, this unconventional case led to an unconventional conviction. So for purposes of interpreting Section 47 of the Constitution, we have to look at what is the intention of the drafters of the Constitution. It is to afford someone with the right to appeal an opportunity to deal with those matters so that they can stand for office. And of course, what the opposition said in this instance is, you know, like you say, it's a matter that is neither here nor there. The fundamental question to ask is contempt of court an offense? And your answer is an absolute yes. And the second question you must then ask, was Zuma guilty of contempt of court? And the answer is an absolute yes. And on those answers, Zuma was then convicted of an offense. And therefore, whether or not we argued the process, whether or not we want to say it does not follow the Constitution, there was a conviction which was made by the highest court. Couldn't appeal, particularly because the Constitutional Court is the highest court and the final arbiter in such cases, and no one can appeal against the Constitutional Court on these matters. So that's the second ground. And I do think as well, if you listen to the cases, if you look at the heads of arguments and the line of arguments, as I've just alluded to them now, that it's a fundamentally flawed argument that MK is making, because one, we've got to look at what the judges have made, and the IEC or rather the Electoral Court can't go against a conviction that is made and pronounced on a conviction of a Constitutional Court and say that the Constitutional Court was not constitutionally compliant in arriving at a particular decision. It's beyond its powers. In fact, that is what would be ultra virus and not the other way around.
The Constitutional Court,
exactly.
Yeah.
So that's point number two. And point number three is on the issue of the sentencing. And I do think that that is where the meat of the skeleton lies.
Mm-hmm.
On this issue, the basis of MK's case is that, well, as far as the issue of the sentencing is concerned, we know, and it is declared, that Zuma was initially sentenced for a period of 15 months. And the Act requires that if you have been sentenced for a period of more than 12 months, you cannot stand as a member of parliament.
Yes.
But what we should focus on is that Zuma was released, firstly, on medical parole. That was subsequently held to be an unconstitutional or unlawful medical parole. And then he had to go back to prison. But when he went back to prison to continue serving the remainder of his sentence, which would have been 12 months because he had initially served
3 months,
he was then confronted with what we call a remission of sentence in law, which means the president had remitted Zuma's sentence along with others. And that, what MK says, is That, in effect, reduced the sentence of Zuma to 3 months, and that is the effect of remission of law. Because Zuma served his 3 months, released on parole, and then there was the remission of sentence, the effect of the remission is that the sentence was then set aside. Remission is therefore to extinguish the remainder of the sentence by Zuma. And therefore, he qualifies, if one has to look at the constitutional construction of Section 47, that he has not been sentenced for a period more than 12 years, because in this case, the effect of the remission, it's just been 3 months. And I do think that that is the strong argument that MK has made. And if they are to win this case, it will solely be on that argument of the sentencing, because that is what the effect of the sentencing is. But the opponents, or not the opponents, sorry, the opposition argued that, well, we have to read the construct of what sentencing is and who has the powers to sentence as far as Section 47 is concerned. One is, you can't separate the duty to convict and the duty to sentence. That duty lies with the courts, and no one else can interfere with that duty except the courts themselves. So no one can change the outcome of a sentence except the courts themselves. Now, if a president makes
no one can change the outcome of the sentencing or the sentencing, because my mind is saying the IEC will probably argue that it's not the amount of months spent in jail that we are worried about here. It is the sentence that we are making reference to. Yes. And the fact that the president, I don't know how you say this, remissioned, how do you say it?
Remitted, yes.
Remitted, yes. Zuma's case, I mean, a sentence, is not a removal of the sentence. It's simply an issue of the powers and privileges of a president. But the sentence was made by a court of law.
Well, that is what IEC is arguing, and right. You're correct in that point. That is precisely what they are arguing, that, you know, if one looks at the construct of Section 47, the intention of the legislators is to prevent lawbreakers from being
lawmakers. Yeah, I heard that, yeah.
You know, and therefore, you can't have the very same lawmakers who then come to change decisions of the court as far as sentencing is concerned, you know. And therefore, to that extent, we have to read the power to convict and the power to sentence to be absolutely restrained within the parameters of the courts and the judges. The president might exercise his own prerogative to remit a sentence or to give a pardon in certain circumstances, but that to say, this is the argument from the IEC, does not necessarily do away with the sentence. But I think that is a difficult argument to say, to make, because one would ultimately have to look at what is the purpose of a sentence. You know, so by remission, we do not reduce you to house arrest. And this is some of the questioning that came from the judges to say, well, if one is remitted from a sentence, unlike in the case of medical peril, if Zuma was still subject to medical peril, he would certainly not be qualified to stand. But his sentence was remitted, which means his sentence was expunged, which means the correctional services no longer has authority over him, because it is perceived that his sentence is complete merely because it was set aside, so to speak. And there were a number of synonyms that were used of what it actually means to remit a sentence, and phrases such as set aside, phrases such as reduce, phrases such as to set apart.
Lindo, help my lay mind to the legal space. What does remittance mean? And how is remittance different to pardon? What does remittance mean?
Yes, okay. So let us look at it from these two perspectives.
Yep.
And I like the fact that you ask what pardon means.
Yep.
With the pardon, you are pardoned from a conviction, and you are also pardoned from a sentence. So pardon goes both ways. And then with the remission of sentence, it only affects the sentence and not the conviction. So with the pardon, your entire crime, conviction thereof, is absolutely pardoned. We forgive you for this act.
Yeah.
You know, and then when it comes to the remission of the sentence, it's just the sentence.
So, and that is the effect of a remittance of a sentence. And let's for a moment just forget about the case that we're talking about now, but just objectively speaking, does the remittance of a sentence mean it is an expungement as if it never existed? In other words, it is struck off the records of such a sentence?
It seems to be one of the areas that are gray, because that case was ventilated.
Because I'm jumping in because I'm running out of time. Because it sounds to me as though that's really where the MK and former President Jacob Zuma have a case. It appears to me that the other two are sort of sealed. They don't really work so well. But this one seems as though this particular argument seems to be the one where there can be a real bone of contention. And it means, or it seems to be centered around, what do we mean by a remittance? Does that mean that it is a total expansion, expungement of the sentence, or it is simply saying that we pardon you, or we excuse you from continuing with the conviction itself? Which is it?
Yeah, so it's not very clear. It's very grey, and that is where the meat is, because what MK is arguing is that it means that the remainder of the sentence is completely expunged. It's off your record. You are perceived to have only served the sentence that you initially served,
which is 3 months.
3 months in this case. Yeah,
and that would allow him to then stand, because it would be less than the 12 months as stipulated by Section 42.
Precisely.
What do you think?
So what?
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, so what the IEC is also saying, on the other hand, is no. What the remittance does is to give you a benefit to be out of prison. And it's not necessarily to say you were not sentenced for 15 months. That was a declaration and an order of the Constitutional Court. To the extent that that was the order of the Constitutional Court, it can't be changed by the president, and that would be an issue of separation of powers. So the point that is made by the IEC is that would be creating a complete the point. Yeah, as far as the separation of powers is concerned, merely because the president may change orders and cases made by judges, and that cannot be. Might exercise is an executive prerogative, but that does not change the ultimate outcome of the case in a particular matter.
Yeah.
So I think that is where this matter is very difficult, and I think it can go either way, and totally based on what and how the judges choose to interpret the provisions of remittance. I'm leaning more towards the side of the MK, merely because they seem to have used some of I think there's some Smith cases which makes reference to previous cases where remittance was used and how those have been dealt with historically. You know,
so there is precedence for the argument that they're putting forward to say, listen, when there's a remittance, it basically means that the rest of the sentence after the remittance becomes null and void. What is then taken into consideration is only that which you have served. And in this case, it would be 3 months for former President Jacob Zuma.
Yes, absolutely.
Sure.
And like I said, it's an absolutely a difficult case, and it can go either way. You know, I guess one making up their own minds based on what is presented before the courts, because I think the court also had a difficulty in trying to understand and follow the arguments that were made by the IEC in that, well, this actually means that the full sentence has been served. So they interrogated, what does then it mean if someone is remitted? Does it mean that the entire sentence has been served? How do we look at it conceptually, theoretically, and practically? And how do we apply this in law? And of course, based on the difficulty of responding to those practical questions, one can merely say what the judges, or not say per se, guess where the matter is likely to go. But of course, it's always difficult to anticipate where such matters go, especially where it's not very set on stone or where there is not a very clear precedent that we can rely on legally.
Well, one thing you can say about President Jacob Zuma and anywhere he sort of steps legally is that he tests the boundaries of any notion.
Yes,
and I suppose tomorrow is going to be a very interesting day as the electoral court decides on this particular matter, right?
Absolutely, and I think that's the beauty of our constitutional democracy. You know, we constantly test the strength of our courts, the strength of our democracy, and perhaps the one more thing which speaks to that strength of our courts and our institutions that was raised by MK was the issue of bias. I did not touch on that. So there was a commissioner who was part of the determination that Zuma is not fit to, or is not qualified to stand as a candidate in this election. And she had pronounced, I think somewhere in January, that I think she was responding to a particular question that was asked if Zuma would be able to stand, and she had referred to the law that it would be the law that would prohibit Zuma from standing for office, and referencing, of course, in particular, Section 47 of the Constitution. Now, MK is saying, well, that was to apply the Constitution to the facts already. She had already applied the matter before it was put before her to determine. Yeah. And by doing so, I mean, a few months later, we then see three objections on the very point that she had raised. And on those bases, they are saying that she is biased. And if a court finds that she is biased, then the entire decision of the IEC is null. Which is also an interesting dynamic.
Absolutely.
Right? So which I do think that on these two aspects, you know, one should expect that the court would, if they find in favor of Zuma and MK, they would probably find that on the basis of the sentencing or on the basis of bias.
Lindo Ntuli, thank you so much for joining us, my brother. I appreciate your elucidation of the matter, and we look to the electoral court tomorrow as to which way they decide, and really appreciate your insights into this matter. Much appreciated.
Thank you, Aubrey, and your listeners.
All right. Lindo Ntuli is an attorney at ENS Africa.